Hey guys, how's things? Oh yeah, good. Yeah, happy Friday to you. Hopefully, you get the weekends off. Have a couple of days coming up. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. It's possible that's why you're listening, because you knew that this is what was going to happen, but maybe it's an accident. And you're just listening to Ernie and wondered what came on next. Well, I come on next. Scott Horton Show here on the Liberty Radio Network, LRN.FM, or LibertyRadioNetwork.com. I'm here every weekday from noon to 2 Eastern Time, 11 to 1 Texas Time. And, you know, it's basically revisionist history in real time. Libertarian foreign policy. Today on the show, Andy Worthington. Our good friend Andy Worthington is going to be back on the show. I've been missing Andy Worthington. I'm glad to have the opportunity to talk with him again coming up here in just a little while. Good news. Shocker Armour is being released from Guantanamo Bay. What's he doing there? Well, he's kidnapped. Yeah, no reason to believe he is a terrorist or anything like that. Well, we're going to find out. Andy Worthington's going to tell us, but he's the last Brit in Guantanamo. And I think it's pretty obvious why they haven't released him. It's because they're afraid of what he'll say. Well, now they're just going to have to deal with that. In fact, we have an article that mentions Shocker Armour today on antiwar.com by Joseph Margulies, who is, I'm not sure who all, but he's the lawyer of some of these guys anyway. And he got permission for one of his guys, one of his clients in there, to publish a book. And he's trying to get permission to publish, to allow Abu Zubaydah to publish a book. Abu Zubaydah, who we know was put through the worst of the torture regime along with Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, but who was not who they thought he was. He was basically a travel agent for people traveling to Afghanistan. His ties to Al-Qaeda were basically helping them get their wives and kids to come to Afghanistan to visit and then send them back home again. That kind of thing. So, he had ties to Al-Qaeda, but he was not the number three guy in Al-Qaeda. Now, when Bush invokes, Zubaydah for the torture program and say, look, we had to do it. For example, this guy, Abu Zubaydah, we tortured him. He's the number three guy in Al-Qaeda, and we learned all this important stuff. And then as Ron Susskind reports, George Tenet finally confronted George W. Bush and said, actually, Mr. President, it turns out that he's really not who we thought he was, and the FBI was right that he's, you know, a lower level guy and didn't have all this actionable intelligence like we thought, etc. And Bush got all mad and said to George Tenet, I said he was important. You're not going to make me lose face on this, are you? And Tenet agreed that, no, sir. No, not at all. Never dream of such a thing, Mr. President. Anyway, so Joseph Margulies is trying to get Abu Zubaydah's book published, and he says it'll make you sick, physically sick. And that's why he thinks you should see it. So I don't know. I guess we'll see if that ever happens. I'll be very interested to hear what Shocker Armour has to say once he gets safely back to Britain. But anyway. Boy, I guess it's just going to be a torture kind of a show because I'm going to have a former CIA officer to talk about torture too. Not a torturer spinning for torturers. Oh no. It's going to be Phil Giraldi talking about how he thinks that all the torturers belong in prison cells. He's got a great new review. You heard about this, where Tenet and some of the other principals in charge of the CIA's torture program have now written a book attempting to refute the Senate report. And, you know, I guess they're following the Cheney playbook, basically, that if they just get out there and stay loud saying this was a policy decision, then maybe they'll keep themselves out of prison. I don't think they really have anything to worry about. If a deputy sheriff can torture and murder people and get away with it, then I'm pretty sure the highest levels of the CIA don't have any prosecution to fear. They've got sovereign immunity, after all. But apparently they're worried, so they've written a book incriminating themselves more. And so Phil Giraldi's going to be on to talk a bit about that, because he wrote a great piece reviewing their excuse book for the American Conservative magazine. So that's good. All right. Yeah, man. So that's the show today. Plus, I got a ton of news to cover. Also, I'll tell you this. Today, this morning, I was interviewed on the Tom Woods Show. And I was interviewed on the Tom Woods Show because someone made the case that, oh, come on, you know, the Iraq War was a mistake in good faith and Saddam really was a threat and this kind of thing. Which to me basically reads like, come on, I don't want to have to admit that I fell for a stupid lie, so in order to assuage my cognitive dissonance, I'm just going to claim that, no, there really was a pretty strong case for war, right? No, I'm afraid not. So, and I'm trying to remember, I kind of think maybe I actually did an interview just like this with Tom Woods before about going back and debunking the case for Iraq War II. There's like kind of a, it's funny. It's not quite a memory. It's like a faint echo of a thing. I mean, I know I've done it on other shows before, but it seemed like I did a Tom Woods show like that at one point, but it also seems like I would remember it better if I had. But anyway, I just tried to come up with as best I could explain about who was behind the war, why they wanted to have a war, why they, you know, settled on weapons of mass destruction as their excuse for the war, why they knew they were lying, why they knew they were lying about Saddam and Osama being buddies and working together on 9/11 and or other things, as best I could. And then, you know, Tom always does a really good job, like I don't, doing the show notes and filling out the blog entry for each show with links to as much as he can. Well, I filled out one hell of a show notes for Tom Woods for this episode. So virtually, I mean, and you guys can get back to me if you think I missed anything in the notes, but virtually everything I refer to in the article, I then went and proved in an email to Tom. Here's the evidence for all of my assertions. And then plus my collection of 16 of the best articles about the neocons and how they lied us into war that I put out last March is in there too. So, or is it 18 or 20 or whatever it ended up? So, there you go. The case against Iraq War II. The case against believing that Iraq War II was launched in any sort of good faith whatsoever. That's my, and I am the, I think he said, the 499th show. I am the 499th episode of the Tom Woods Show. Isn't that great? And like I told him, I'm really grateful to Tom. You know, we've been friends for, I don't know, what is it, 15? Oh, we've been friends for 10 years at least, since 2005 at least. But him having me on his show has been so good for this show. All the time I get tweets, I get emails, I get PayPal donations that have, hey, I heard of you from Tom Woods written all over them. So, all you new, you know, fans and friends that I picked up, supporters and whatever from the Tom Woods Show, thanks. And you're soon to be in good company because I did another Tom Woods Show. TomWoods.com. It'll post, I guess, today or tomorrow. Hey, all Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at darrenscoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world. All specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. darrenscoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and you get free shipping. darrenscoffee.com.
Don't you get sick of the Israel lobby trying to get us into more wars in the Middle East? Or always abusing Palestinians with your tax dollars? It once seemed like the lobby would always have full-spectrum dominance on the foreign policy discussion in D.C. But those days are over. The Council for the National Interest is the America lobby, standing up and pushing back against the Israel lobby's undue influence on Capitol Hill. Go show some support at councilforthenationalinterest.org. That's councilforthenationalinterest.org.
All right, you guys. Welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. Hey, listen, let me tell you again. On the 10th of October, I'm giving a speech at the Texas Millennial Institute Conference. Make conversation, not war. It's in Fort Worth, Texas. And it's going to be myself, Angela Keaton, Ted Carpenter, and Jacob Hornberger. All giving speeches, all on foreign policy. It's Saturday, October the 10th in Fort Worth at Texas Christian University. And it's free. So come on out. I know anywhere in Texas is far from anywhere else in Texas because it's a big place, but still. The Texas Millennial Institute's Foreign Policy Summit. Go to texasmillennialinstitute.org. texasmillennialinstitute.org. And you can see me and Angela, Ted Carpenter, and Jacob Hornberger. I've never met Ted Carpenter before. Of course, Angela Keaton is my good friend since both helped to rebuild the Branch Davidians Church back in 1999. Jacob Hornberger's been my friend since at least 2004, something like that. The head of the Future Freedom Foundation, sponsor of the show, of course. Ted Carpenter, I don't know him. He's a Cato guy, and he's not Doug Bandow, but I guess he's pretty good on stuff. I don't really read him that often. Actually, that's not really true. I guess we run stuff by him on antiwar.com from time to time. Seems like a good guy. For the most part, so that's cool. Be good to meet him. And of course, you already know what speech I'm going to give. The Middle East is all screwed up, and it's all America's fault, and we should quit now. Obviously. All right, so there's that. By the way, I'm still working on trying to get this lady from Counterpunch. I'm sorry, I forget her name off the top of my head, but she wrote a great thing about Yemen. And how horrible what's going on in Yemen is, and how everybody's just ignoring Yemen. Here we are Friday, and if I don't get her, then that's a whole nother week without a Yemen interview on this show. Which just means I'm letting y'all down bad, and I'm sorry. I don't think I've had anyone on in the last week to talk about it. Let's see if we got anything new in here on it. You know, I could just maybe try to get Larison on if she can't do it. Because Larison, at least, you know, can say all the same really good stuff again. And I know he's paying attention to the story. Alright, well, anyway. Sorry, I'm sitting here reading quietly to myself while I'm live on the radio. We got the torture angle covered on the show today. We got to talk about Syria here. Syria claims tacit deal between U.S. and Russia on ending the war. Oh, man, I hope that that's true. In an interview on Syrian state media today, top government advisor Bouthania Shaban claimed there is a tacit agreement between the U.S. and Russia on coming to some sort of agreement to end the ongoing civil war. Well, sort of pseudo-civil war, and that some sort of negotiated settlement could happen soon. The Russians have been making claims to this effect for months, But the latest comments come just a day after State Department officials publicly disavowed the notion and condemned Russia, suggesting they oppose the Russian strategy of negotiated settlement unless it includes unilateral surrender of the Assad government. Man, you know what? It pisses me off. You know, when it's what the Obama government wants, look how easy it is to get MoveOn.org and all them to rally all the rank-and-file Democrat troops to support the Iran deal. But what would it take to get them to say, hey, damn it, negotiate an end to this war right now? Everybody knows that Turkey and Saudi and Qatar and Jordan are American sock puppet satellite states. And everybody knows that America's really Israel's satellite state. But from time to time, America can have a lot of influence over Israel. And certainly if they were to say out loud, okay, that's enough support for Jabhat al-Nusra, please, Israel, thank you, then that might, you know, going ahead calling them out publicly should be enough. And that's the negotiation. You can't negotiate with al-Qaeda or the Islamic State, but you could negotiate with all their patrons and just let the Turks, the Qataris, the Saudis know, covert op canceled. And that would be our side of the agreement. And, of course, this whole thing about Assad must go in the first place is just a poison pill. And just imagine if the Republicans were doing this right now, what rank-and-file liberal Democrats would be saying. In fact, remember, they did scream quite correctly about it when it came out that Ehud Olmert was trying to negotiate a peace deal with Assad and that George Bush intervened and ruined it. Ron Paul was actually the best on that at the time. Said, you know, here we fight their wars for them, but then when they're trying to make peace, we prevent them from making peace. This whole thing is ridiculous. Yesterday on the show, this is just the advantage of being a radio show, okay? I get to say things like, yesterday on the show, Julian Borger of The Guardian reported his story that the former president of Finland, the president, not the House Speaker or the chairman of some committee, the former president of Finland, himself a Nobel Peace Prize winner, says that the Russians made an offer to negotiate Assad leaving power, transfer of power, at the beginning of 2012. And the Americans, the Brits, the French, and I guess the GCC allies were so convinced that Assad was going to fall any day now that they decided against that deal. Better to destroy the entire government in Damascus than just get rid of the fascist dictator at the top. They reason, because it's so easy. And yet, as I was arguing the point yesterday with Borger, it had already been half a year. It had already been almost a full year since the uprising began. It had already been a full half a year, 6 months, since August of 2011, when Obama first said that Assad must go. So how in the world could they have been telling themselves, yeah, it's easy, he'll be gone any day now? Gaddafi laid down and died. That was easy enough. Simple battle of the East versus the West. America picked the side of the East. Sent in spies and rangers with laser pointers to obliterate the enemy. It took a long time, nine full months of war. But eventually they ran Gaddafi out of power and got rid of him. But Gaddafi had hardly any supporters except his very own core of loyal people. I guess. He sure didn't have the kind of population that Assad has supporting him. And they all hate him, but they support him anyway. In fact, that's a Patrick Coburn story on antiwar.com right now. The Kurds, the Syrian Kurds, hate Assad, but they prefer him to al-Nusra. Surprise, surprise. So we could have peace, but the Democrats just won't let us have it. That's all.
Hey, Al, Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. This nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone. We are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at scotthorton.org or thewarstate.com.
Superior blends of premium coffee. Roasted fresh in Zionsville, Indiana. Darren's Coffee satisfies the casual and the connoisseur. Scott Horton Show listeners, visit darrenscoffee.com and use the coupon code SCOTT at checkout for free shipping. darrenscoffee.com. Because everyone deserves to drink great coffee.
All right, well, Andy Worthington's stuck on the other line, y'all, I guess. We'll try him again in 10 minutes. I was going to find off the corner of my eye here. Out of the corner of my eye, I was trying to find the great hilarious Bush clip on the Geneva Conventions, but yeah, not so much. Where the hell is it? Well, whatever. All right, so it's my show, Scott Horton Show. And we'll have Andy Worthington on here in a few. We'll try him again, and then Phil Giraldi. Andy on military torture, Giraldi on CIA torture. So, you know, it's important to cover all our bases here, you know. Yeah. All right, so here's something I've been meaning to talk about all week and never got a chance to. Oh, there's Israel-Palestine stuff I need to talk about. This one is from the New York Times on the 21st. Deadly car bombing at Somalia's presidential palace is claimed by al-Shabaab. And then this one is Cora Courier at The Intercept. Somali drone victims seeks justice. Whoops. Somali drone victim seeks justice for U.S. strike in German courts. And that's because they run AFRICOM out of Germany. So they're using that for standing there. And of course, these are part of the same story, America's war in Somalia. And you might just think, well, hey, there's a bunch of terrorists there and they're just like al-Qaeda. They call themselves al-Shabaab. They claim loyalty to al-Qaeda, and so who cares about bombing them to death, man? Somebody claims that they're loyal to Ayman al-Zawahiri. Somebody wants to blow them up, and I'm supposed to be concerned about this? Right, that's conventional wisdom. But here's the thing about that. Is America created al-Shabaab? No, not in the direct, you know, helped create al-Qaeda back in the 80s or, you know, Israel created Hamas kind of way, but more in a Israel created Hezbollah kind of way, just blowback and backlash. Because, see, America, after September 11th, started supporting the warlords from the battle days of Black Hawk Down back in 1993 when they killed the Rangers and the Delta Force there. And, in fact, Adeed, the warlord that they were after at the time of Black Hawk Down, the CIA started supporting his son and their friends after September 11th, find us Islamists and kill them for us. And here's guns and money. Well, so the warlords, of course, went after their own enemies. And if they brought an Islamist scalp here or there to the CIA, fine. But point being is they grew more and more powerful. And, of course, abused the people of Somalia more and more to the point where they started losing. And the different factions on the ground in anarcho-Somalia started to coalesce. You know, war is the health of the state. They started to coalesce into a monopoly government in order to thwart the will of the warlords being backed by the CIA. And that's exactly what they did. They came together. And by the way, anarcho-Somalia was not paradise, but it was the best Somalia had ever done ever, by many measures. But anyway, that all ended. That all ended back in 2002, and that was still with the CIA intervening at the time. But that all ended in 2002 and 3, and these guys kicked the warlords out. So the CIA backed them even more. They reinvaded, caused even more trouble. And in the beginning of 2005, or halfway through 2005 or so, all the disparate groups throughout all of southern Somalia came together to create what was called the Islamic Courts Union. They were not bin Ladenites. They were not radicals. They were all conservative old men, the uncles and grandfathers and imams of the community, basically the last men standing after all the warlords had fought each other to a standstill or to death. And it was the conservative old men who inherited the power just enough to ward off the CIA-backed warlords. But at that point, oh, they made the mistake of putting the name Islamic in their name. And the Bush administration went nuts. And in Christmas 2006, oh, and at that time, pardon me, the Islamic Courts Union, it was called a union because it was 13 different groups that came together. And it was the 13th, the smallest and the weakest and the least influential, the young men, al-Shabaab, the youth, were the basically the afterthought in the Islamic Courts Union. Then on Christmas Day, 2006, Bush had enforced the WikiLeaks, thank you Chelsea Manning, the WikiLeaks prove that George W. Bush's government forced Ethiopia to invade Somalia to overthrow the Islamic Courts Union, raping and pillaging and murdering women and children and committing war crimes all the way around, including even capturing and torturing American citizens while they were at it, with special forces and CIA leading the whole thing. And then they stayed and they occupied the place. The Christian Ethiopian army, backed by the United States, occupying their, you know, eternal enemy, I guess, in the Muslim Somalis. And it was only then that the Islamic Courts Union broke apart, of course, was smashed. And al-Shabaab, the youth, were the ones who were fighting. They're the youth. So they're the young men with the rifles. And they're the ones who drove, eventually, it took about a year and a half, they drove the Ethiopians out. And then, since then, Bush and then Obama has continued the policy of bringing in the Kenyans, the Ethiopians again, Ugandans and Burundians as well, under the auspices of the AU, to occupy Somalia and foist on them this, you know, U.S. and U.N. created government. And, it's even admitted in, Jeremy Scahill's book, on page 222 of Jeremy Scahill's book, Dirty Wars, he quotes a State Department official admitting that they wanted to keep Sheikh Sharif, who had been the leader of the Islamic Courts Union, all along. They didn't even really want to get rid of him. They just wanted to bring him down a peg or two. And so they caused this horrible war that killed at least tens and tens of thousands of people in the fighting. As I said, war crimes, rapes, and murders, all this very well documented. And then on Obama's watch especially, in 2011 and 12, they suffered a massive famine, which all of the Horn of Africa suffered, but the Somalis suffered it the worst by many orders of magnitude, because they're in the middle of a war. And so whatever crops were ever even harvested, nobody could sell them. Nobody had any money. All of the markets were closed. All the distribution channels disrupted. And so according to the U.S. and the U.K. and their NGO that they back called FuseNet, which is the famine early warning system is what it's called, FuseNet, they reported in 2013, that 655, that was killed in the Iraq war by 2004. 600 something thousand women and children had died in Somalia, starved to death, laid down on the side of the road and died in 2011 and 12. And that was, you know, it was Obama's fault. It was America's fault. And in fact, Tony Lake was put in charge of distributing the food aid and did nothing. If you remember Tony Lake, he was the guy that Bill Clinton tried to make the head of the CIA and the Senate rejected him. And he was the guy who, I'm sure you can still find this on Frontline somewhere, on the internet somewhere, on Frontline, they did a special on Black Hawk Down. And one of the fathers of one of the dead Rangers said that he confronted Bill Clinton and said, hey, you were trying to negotiate with Adid. And Bill Clinton says, yeah, that's right, we're negotiating. He says, well, then how come you sent my son to arrest him, to capture him on the at the same time you're negotiating with him? And the father said, Bill Clinton looked at me with the most blank stare I've ever seen on a man's face. And he just said, well, I asked Tony Lake the same question. And that was it. So Tony Lake, who basically botched Black Hawk Down, that entire thing, was also the same guy that oversaw the starvation of 600,000 women and children, mostly babies younger than 5 years old. Now go chant USA, USA for 4 minutes and we'll be right back.
Hey, Al Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. And if this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Robertson Roberts Brokerage Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Robertson Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co.
Hey, L. Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new ebook by longtime Future Freedom author Scott McPherson. Freedom and Security, the Second Amendment and the Right to Keep and Bear Arms. This is the definitive principled case in favor of gun rights and against gun control. America is exceptional. Here the people come first, and we refuse to allow the state a monopoly on firearms. Our liberty depends on it. Get Scott McPherson's Freedom and Security, the Second Amendment and the Right to Keep and Bear Arms on Kindle at Amazon.com today. All right, you guys, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, Scott Horton Show. Oh, ear goggles on. Hey, man, one of the great heroes of the story of Guantanamo Bay is Andy Worthington. He's a British journalist, and he's our best journalist on Guantanamo prison. He wrote the book, The Guantanamo Files. He did a movie called Outside the Law, and he's written 10 million articles all over the place, the Future Freedom Foundation and all over, about the inhumanity of the Guantanamo gulag, and is the expert on virtually every aspect of this controversy, of this illegal, unconstitutional American prison down there in communist Cuba all this time. And very happy to welcome him back to the show. It's been way too long. Hi, Andy. How are you?
Hi, yeah. It has been a while, hasn't it?
Yeah, well, I mean, not much has been changing down there. There's not too much news to cover. Lots of misery, but nothing new.
Well, actually, we have had a problem in that for many months. There hasn't been that much news.
Yeah. I did actually talk to the lady from Newsweek who did this story about the kid that got released to Amman, who had been in there completely innocent and brutalized because he came from a town in Yemen called Al-Qaeda.
Exactly.
And admitted as such, yeah. And that one, I mean, that story, I probably botched that interview, but the article that she wrote about it was just absolutely incredible. But anyway, so we covered that, but other than that, there has not been very much. But now, today, there's really big news, and this is something that you have made a real project of yours, you know, within the larger story of Guantanamo, and that is the man who's known as the last Brit in Guantanamo prison, Shocker Armour. So tell us, you know, who is he, and what's the news?
Well, you know, Shocker Armour is this, by all accounts, extremely charismatic, intelligent guy who has fought against the injustice with which the prisoners have been treated ever since he was first picked up in Afghanistan nearly 14 years ago. He'd gone there with his family to work on humanitarian aid projects for the Afghan people. And he was first approved for release under President Bush in 2007. That was when he was told, you know, we don't want to carry on holding you. We'll make the arrangements for you to leave. And he wasn't released. And then when President Obama got in, he set up fairly swiftly, you know, obviously we all remember that he promised to close Guantanamo within a year. Then he fairly swiftly set up a Guantanamo review task force to review the cases of the prisoners to decide what he wanted to do with them, which was maybe what he should have done before he made the promise to close it. Because these guys then spent a year meeting every week and going through the files of the prisoners, you know, which was obviously a good thing to do, but it led to very little actually happening on the ground in those first few months, which enabled, you know, his opponents in Congress to really start, you know, acting as though he didn't know what he was doing. But these guys went away and they reviewed the cases and they came back and they said, you know, such and such. Basically, they said 2/3 of the people that are held should be released. They said that of the rest of them, there are, you know, several dozen people who should be put on trial. And the rest of them we think are too dangerous to release, but we haven't got the evidence. bad news to have that thing kind of committed to print that they actually said, we think they're too dangerous to release, but we can't prove it. But anyway, Shaka Amer was in the group of men to be freed. And over the years, since the task force issued its recommendations, depending on how the ebb and flow of power within the U.S. establishment as to whether President Obama's been pushing for things or whether Congress has been pushing back, many of these men have been released. I mean, over 100 of these men that the task force said should be released have been released. And all the while, Shaka Amer wasn't released, even though it's obvious to me that the United States' closest ally in the war on terror has been my home country, the UK. And here's Shaka Amer, the last British guy there, still waiting while all the other British residents were returned.
Yep. And you know, I talked with somebody at Reprieve. It wasn't Clive. It was, you know, one of his assistants or associates there. But they talked about how Obama personally, I think on TV, had said to David Cameron, yes, I'm ordering him released to you, or, you know, something very much along those lines. And how it looked to them like just simple insubordination on the part of the military, that they were refusing to comply with the president's order on that. What did you make of that?
Well, what he actually, you know, what he did was that David Cameron raised it with Obama in January, and President Obama said that he would prioritize his case. And, you know, we don't really know what that means, that he said he would prioritize it. The fact is that, you know, a prisoner approved for release from Guantanamo by the task force is acting on behalf of the president. Now, you know, it's not legally binding in any way that that these decisions have to be followed through on. Ask the Yemenis. There are dozens of Yemenis in Guantanamo who were told in 2009, 2010 that the U.S. didn't want to hold them. They're still held because the entire U.S. establishment is terrified of releasing Yemenis because they fear for this al-Qaeda offshoot in Yemen. And now, of course, with the country descending into hell, then, you know, they're absolutely refusing to release any Yemenis. Now, the issue with Shaka Amer was that here you have this high-level review board which had suggested that that Shaka Amer should go home. And, you know, the country in question is America's closest ally, the UK. There's no question of anybody saying, but we don't trust the UK. They're not in a position to be able to, you know, to look after this guy when he comes back. It's been insulting to the UK from the very beginning. Now, you know, the only other issue going on here is that we've heard rumors and whispers over the years that actually one of the reasons for the delay was that because Shaka Amer's so outspoken and because he's seen and heard about so many things over the years, everybody wanted to keep him shut up. And the best way for them to do that, apart from keeping him in Guantanamo, would be to release him to Saudi Arabia, his home country, where, of course, he would be silent. But, you know, that was never practically an option because he's a permanent legal British resident. His British wife is here. His four British children are here. And, you know, what we also have in Britain, I'm very glad to say, Scott, is many, many people with principles and loud voices who would make sure that there's no way that that kind of sneakiness could be achieved. But, you know, I'm sure that over a period of some time, that was a kind of hidden stumbling block to his release. But essentially, it's always been insulting that here we are in the UK, every other UK person in Guantanamo has been freed, and yet Shaka wasn't.
Mm-hmm. And now, what all do you know for a fact about his treatment in CIA and or military custody here, or the worst aspects of it?
Sorry, what do we know about it?
Yeah. I mean, presumably he's got a story to tell they don't want him to tell. Is it about stress positions and worse?
Well, I don't know exactly what it is. You know, I mean, over the years there have been stories about, you know, I mean, he raised a case in the UK about how British agents were in the room when he was being, you know, violently abused by the US authorities in Afghanistan, and I think, you know, that's certainly true.
Mm.
There are other stories about him knowing about things that have happened that, you know, the three men who died in Guantanamo, for example, in June 2006, that he was treated appallingly that night. The main thing that's happened to Shaka Amer over all these years is that he's spent an enormous amount of time in solitary confinement because they've kept him and it must be said, every other prisoner who's capable of agitating in any way, separate from the rest of the prisoners, to try and make sure that, you know, that they don't cause trouble. And, you know, and that's been the case with Shaka, that I don't know quite how many years he spent in solitary confinement, but a huge amount of time. Mm. And it's, I think, you know, obviously a testament to his strength of will that he's, by all accounts, you know, pretty much survived this, these many, many years on and off that he's been held in isolation. But, you know, he's physically, he's got a catalogue of physical complaints. And I'm sure, like, you know, like everybody who's still there in Guantanamo after 13 years, you know, the mental checklist isn't going to be so great either as to quite in what ways they're suffering.
Well, you know, there's this piece today at Al Jazeera, yesterday at Al Jazeera America by Joseph Margulies, who's a lawyer representing some of these guys. And he talked about how they published Majid Khan's book and how he's trying to get permission to publish Abu Zubaydah. And, you know, this is the guy who underwent the worst of the CIA torture. And then it turned out that, oops, he wasn't the number three guy in Al-Qaeda after all, et cetera, like that.
And they don't want to release a single word of it. Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, it seems like they really are worried about these stories coming out. They're working very hard to prevent Margulies from publishing any more of these type memoirs. So it'll be very interesting to see what Amr has to say when he finally, you know, can get his act together a little bit and you know, figure out what kind of statement he wants to make or if he wants to publish a book, something like that.
Because, well, in a way, I would think that there's probably nothing that we haven't heard before, to be honest.
Yeah, but that's all right. You know, make it new again because, you know, it's still shocking stuff. It's always shocking to hear the details. But now that the time has passed, in a way, you know, it's a double-edged sword. They're like, yeah, that was a long time ago. But also, people are not so invested in identifying themselves with the American right who accomplished this, the Bush government and all their political acolytes. So maybe it's a little bit, you know, easier now after a little bit of time to go ahead. Say, hey, the law's the law, and I don't care if you really prosecute these guys. Whereas before, I think, you know, you'd have had just too many American citizens, you know, in on it, basically, in spirit with the Republicans and would want to defend them. So,
well, you know, I mean, I think so much has come out. I mean, you know, so much came out despite the redactions in the executive summary of the torture report. So, you know, the issue, I think, is still, I mean, there's a book just come out by three former CIA chiefs and various other people. I don't know whether you've heard about this. But
yeah, we're actually about to interview Phil Giraldi about it next.
This is the book. Sorry, what's that?
I'm about to interview Phil Giraldi about the book next because he wrote a review of it for the American Conservative.
You know, they're desperate to keep insisting to the public that what they did was legal and useful when, you know, it turns out we've had absolute confirmation from the Senate Intelligence Committee that it wasn't legal and that it wasn't useful. So, you know, what Shaka Amer has to say, it's all part of that story. But what I find as time has gone on is that we know a huge amount. You know, the case for the prosecution against these guys is massive, but nobody's allowing it to actually happen.
Yeah.
And, you know, Shaka, this wonderful, eloquent man who's fought against the injustice and, you know, refused to be beaten. I'm sure he has a fantastically eloquent tale to tell, but there will be nothing in there that will be, you know, the smoking gun that will end up, you know, getting Bush and his cronies in the dock. You know, we have evidence. We have so much evidence, but nobody wants to act on it.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that's true, but at the very least, it's moving the ball forward in terms of the narrative and getting more people to understand. You know, other Scott Horton, the heroic anti-torture human rights lawyer, has pointed out that, you know, hey, man, don't be too pessimistic about the future. The truth is that there are a lot of torturers in the world who do end up being held to account, even if it's 10, 20, 30 years later, you know, this does happen, and so the law is the law, and it will come back and bite you in the ass, even if your last name is Bush. At least it's possible. You know, I don't know. That's a little optimistic for me, but, you know, I could see maybe a case against some of the lawyers or some of the leaders of the CIA program, if not the principals, but anyway.
Well, we have to hope, you know. I mean, I think at some point, You know, I don't think it's all going to go away. So I'm hoping that at some point there'll be a weak link yeah. who, you know.
Yeah, I hope this guy, Shocker Armour, gets out there with a nice British accent and gives a lot of speeches, you know.
Well, you know, I think at the moment what I want for him more than anything else is to get out of there because, of course, you know, unusually the U.S. government has told the British government, and I think that's because at a high level the British government has been complaining about being snubbed by their American friends.
Yeah.
So, you know, we've had a parliamentary group here with cross-party support. They came to a delegation of MPs, including, you know, Tory MPs, our Conservatives, our Republicans, came to Washington in May to ask why Shaka wasn't being released. Then they wrote a very critical op-ed in the New York Times about how their treatment was a slap in the face for Britain. So, you know, we've had this unusual notification, apparently, that, you know, the U.S. government ringing up the British government and saying he's coming home. But from what we understand, it's the beginning of the 30-day process where Congress, you know, insisted that they have the right to hear 30 days before a prisoner is released that a prisoner is going to be released. So he won't be back for several weeks. But, you know, this is great news. And it's, you know, it's so long overdue.
Absolutely. All right, y'all. That is the great Andy Worthington. He's at andyworthington.co.uk. Andyworthington.co.uk. Check out the movie Outside the Law, Stories from Guantanamo, and the book The Guantanamo Files, the stories of 759 detainees in America's illegal prison. Thanks so much for your time again, dude.
Hey, that's great to talk to you, Scott. Thanks very much.
I sure appreciate it. Hey, y'all, Scott here. First, I want to take a second to thank all the show's listeners, sponsors, and supporters for helping make this show what it is. I literally couldn't do it without you. And now I want to tell you about the newest way to help support the show. Whenever you shop at Amazon.com, stop by ScottHorton.org first. And just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page. That way the show will get a kickback from Amazon's end of the sale. It won't cost you an extra cent. And it's not just books. Amazon.com sells just about everything in the world, except cars, I think. So whatever you need, they've got it. Just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page at ScottHorton.org or go to ScottHorton.org/Amazon. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop, which is, by the way, what he's doing right now, selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com. All right, you guys, welcome back. Hey, that Andy Worthington interview went long through the break. I guess you could hear it cut off there. But you'll be able to hear the whole thing in the archives later at ScottHorton.org. Oops. The great Andy Worthington. All right, and not exactly on Guantanamo, but sort of along the same lines. It's Phil Giraldi, former CIA and DIA officer, executive director of the Council for the National Interest, writer for the American Conservative magazine and UNS.com. He's got a piece at the American Conservative, the CIA's torture defenders, about this new book written by a bunch of guilty war criminals called Rebuttal. The CIA responds to the Senate Intelligence Committee's study of its detention and interrogation programs. Welcome back to the show, Phil. How's it going?
I'm fine, Scott. How are you?
I'm doing real good. Must be better than you because I have not read this thing. And I can see you just sitting there, the face palm, reading through this book in order to make your case against it here. First of all, who's who? Who helped write this thing? It's basically just an edited compendium of articles by guilty torturers at CIA?
Well, actually what it is, it's seven separate chapters, each of which is written by one of the seven co-author individuals, and they were obviously edited together in some fashion. Mm-hmm. They don't fit together real neatly, but the central theme essentially is that the detention program and interrogation program, which are better known as rendition and torture, were perfectly not only legitimate, legal, but also saved thousands of American lives. This is kind of the central theme.
Mm-hmm. And you cite the authors here. George Tenet, who was the director of Central Intelligence at the time of 9/11 and through at least the beginning of the torture program and all that. Michael Hayden, who was the head of the NSA on 9/11 and then became the head of the torture program at CIA, or director of the CIA, and therefore head of the torture program. Porter Goss as well. And Jose Rodriguez, John McLaughlin, Michael Morell, John Rizzo, and Philip Mudd. And you say Mudd is actually the one guy on this list of bylines here who was not actually himself guilty of war crimes and conspiracy in the torture case. Is that right?
Yeah, that's because he was not CIA. He's someone who was brought in by the other six to give them credibility, to give the impression to the reader that the entire, let's say, intelligence and security community agrees on this issue, which, of course, it doesn't. But the Mudd is kind of an outlier, you know, that was kind of brought in to legitimize what the others are saying. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I don't know why they didn't just bring in John Yoo or Judge Bybee, but all right. Okay, so now here's the thing. As you write in your article here, the CIA's torture defenders, you're not buying it.
Yeah, that's putting it mildly. I mean, the thing is, basically, of course, they don't refer to it as torture. They refer to it as enhanced interrogation and by a number of other euphemisms. To them, it was all legal and it was well within the bounds of what we'll consider acceptable practice. But of course, that's nonsense. They don't really address that issue. The clear consensus is that when you engage in the practices that were outlined in the Senate Intelligence Committee report, it's torture. Japanese and Germans were executed for doing some of these things that that U.S. Personnel were doing as part of the interrogation program. So there's no question about it. And then they go on from there. You know, it was all legal, and it was this, that, and the other thing. Basically, the whole idea is here to create to throw out a bit of propaganda saying that essentially all this stuff was done in America's interest. One of the interesting things, the first piece is by Tenet, and he says what is missing essentially in the Senate report, I mean, apart from the fact that the Democrats are out to get him and the others, because I guess they presume they're Republicans or something like that. But the other thing he talks about is context. And for him, context is the fact that because 9/11 happened, anything goes. And what he's clearly saying is that there was a panic, and because there was a panic, we went out and tortured people, and that was okay because that's context. And, of course, that's a stupid argument. But Tenet is the one that flies that, and then some of the others kind of pick up on it in theirs, that essentially you have to look at what was going on, you know, around the torture or around the enhanced interrogation. And, of course, that's a bullshit argument.
Well, never even mind, you know, whether it adds up, you know, compared to the law, which specifically says, by the way, no excuse is good enough, national security or anything else. But do you even think it's true at all, or it's just a made-up bunch of crap that they were even afraid or in any kind of panic at all? They knew that Al-Qaeda was a couple of hundred guys and that they'd scored their Hail Mary pass. They, right? I mean, this is a bunch of crap that they were terrified. George Tenet was terrified. Dick Cheney. I could see Dick Cheney being terrified, but...
You know, there are different ways to define terror. What these guys were terrified of was Congress and the president jumping all over them because they weren't being seen to be doing something. And this was doing something. Kofor Black, who was not co-author of this thing, who was head of the Counterterrorism Center at the time, famously said he was going to bring in bin Laden's head on a silver platter and present it to the president. And another occasion, he said something about he would have bin Laden's flies walking around on bin Laden's dead eyes. You know, this kind of stuff. So this is the kind of rhetoric and everything to be tough and tougher and toughest was part of the game. But yeah, terror. No, I mean, if they knew anything about Al Qaeda, they knew basically that, as you say, it was a kind of a lucky one off that they would have extreme difficulty in ever producing again.
Well, we know the story of Ali Soufan and the FBI and how all they did with Abu Zubaydah was treat him with a little bit of respect, give him some ice chips to nibble on as they interrogated him, and he was perfectly happy to spill his guts. Who, me? Yeah, I'm a travel agent. I know all about Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, let me tell you. And he wasn't the number three guy in Al-Qaeda, but he sure knew a lot of useful stuff, and he was happily sharing it with the FBI until the CIA came and kidnapped him and tortured him. And then apparently the first thing they did was lock him away in a box for 3 months. Didn't ask him anything. Just locked him in a box to drive him mad for 3 months without interrogating him at all. So what the hell kind of crap is that?
Yeah, according to Ali Soufan, the excuse they gave was that they needed information faster. And so what they proceed in doing, as you correctly state, is they basically locked him up and didn't talk to him for 3 months. So, there was a lot of nonsense going on. There was obviously rivalry between the CIA and FBI in terms of how to do this stuff. The FBI had it right. Anybody who knows anything about interrogations and what comes out of interrogations knows that the most successful interrogations, the most successful interrogators build rapport with the suspect, and that's how they get good information. And that's the fact of the matter. And here they were, putting on the thumb screws and torturing these people in the belief that that was a better way to go about it. They didn't have a clue. I mean, they should be put in jail for being stupid apart from anything else.
Yeah. Well, and of course, now back to the question of how legal all this supposedly was. All these memos that supposedly legalized this behavior have been repudiated, even by Bush's lawyers, right? It was... and Goldsmith, I think, he wasn't, James Madison or anything like that, but he came in and canceled everything that John Yoo and Jay Bybee and Alberto Gonzalez and the rest had signed off on, saying that this was okay, and said, actually, no, you can't do it no more. Am I wrong about that?
Well, you're right about that, but obviously what Tenet and the others would argue was that they were acting under the U memorandum, which basically said it was legal. And the White House at that time was going along and saying it also was legal. So that was their authorization to do this. But the fact is that, that's blowing smoke, because the fact is that the United States is a signatory to international non-torture treaties and that sort of thing. These things basically exist so that people won't go out and torture people, and they set up in fact, consequences for it. Any country that's a signatory has to prosecute people who engage in torture. And, of course, we've never done that.
Yep. All right, hold it right there. We'll be right back with more from Phil Giraldi, former CIA, not a torturer, right after this. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for MPV Engineering. This isn't for all of you, but for high-end contractors specializing in industrial construction and end users who own and operate industrial equipment. MPV offers licensed professional consulting on chemical and mechanical engineering for your projects. Tanks, pressure vessels, piping, heat exchangers, HVAC equipment, chemical reactors for oil companies or manufacturing facilities, as well as project management support and troubleshooting for those implementing designs. MPV will get your industrial project up and running. Head over to mpvengineering.com. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for Liberty.me, the social network and community-based publishing platform for the liberty-minded. Liberty.me combines the best of social media technology all in one place and features classes, discussions, guides, events, publishing, podcasts, and so much more. And Jeffrey Tucker and I are starting a new monthly show at Liberty.me, Eye on the Empire. It's just $4 a month if you use promo code Scott when you sign up. And hey, once you do, add me as a friend on there at scotthorton.liberty.me. Be free. Liberty.me. All right, you guys, welcome back. Ha ha, House Speaker's resigning. I like it when the House Speaker resigns. I don't care who he is. Or she. In this case, it's John Boehner, so that's kind of nice little Friday news for you. Don't have to look at his ugly crybaby face on TV anymore. Talking with Phil Giraldi, he's a former CIA officer, but was not part of the torture regime. And in fact, you could tell he's kind of mad as hell about the torture regime. And we're talking about it and how... the CIA guys who were the torturers have now come out with this new book pretending to refute the Senate torture report. But according to Phil, failing to do any such thing, his article at the American Conservative is called The CIA's Tortured Defenders. It's the spotlight today on antiwar.com. Or was it yesterday? Anyway. Yeah. Okay, good. And I wanted to ask you about... Sheikh al-Libi and Saddam Hussein, and of course, I think most people know the story now that this guy was an al-Qaeda guy, But he was tortured into pretending that he was buddies with Saddam and that Saddam had taught him and his Al-Qaeda friends how to make chemical weapons. And I think this is also where the story came from, that the anti-terrorist training camp that had an airplane fuselage there and everything outside Baghdad was actually a terrorist training camp where instead of training cops how to kill terrorists, it was there for training terrorists how to hijack planes and that kind of thing, where that came from as well. And so this gets right to the heart of the argument about whether torture works or not. It all depends on the premise of your question. Are you trying to get the truth or are you trying to get some lies? Because if you're trying to get some lies, torture works every time. Even the toughest guy will give in to torture. It's torture, right? So I wonder if they even attempt to address the accusation that they were brutalizing lies about Saddam Hussein out of these people.
No, they don't even come close to that issue. And in fact, in general, they don't even come close to the Iraq War at all in any way. And it's just it's one of the big failures of their account. And it's basically they're essentially doing what they did when they were in office. They're cherry picking information mm-hmm. to support what they see as their argument, and they're ignoring everything else. And the fact is that, you know, yeah, if you're torturing somebody assiduously enough, or as I say in the article, if you're torturing this guy's family right in front of him, he's going to talk. But the fact is, you know, he's going to also be trying to screw you as much as he can. And so he'll throw in maybe a little bit of truth and a lot of BS. And so at a certain point, he'll just be agreeing with whatever you're saying because he knows what you want to hear. And so torture is a very inefficient way to try to get information. And of course, they always trot out McLaughlin in his piece, trotted out this ticking time bomb nonsense that you got to torture these people because otherwise there'd be thousands of dead Americans. And of course, there is not a single example that anyone can cite, Israelis or Americans or anybody else, where torturing somebody produced information that interdicted or stopped a terrorist action that would have killed innocent civilians. It's never happened.
And did they try to?
You sorry?
Oh, go ahead. Go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, it's never happened. So it's the argument they always make. Alan Dershowitz is fond of making this in his arguments justifying torture, and it's an argument that's been picked up by all these people, but it's a fake argument because it's never happened.
Yep, and you know, Jane Mayer at the New Yorker actually did a great story about how the TV show 24 was actually created by a partisan associate of Karl Rove for the purpose of normalizing this ticking time bomb scenario in the minds of the American people. That was the purpose of the show, not to entertain you or to sell you dish soap, but to sell you torture, and that was where it came from. And so I wonder this, in the book, do they pretend to go back to their story that torture led to the courier that led to bin Laden, or do they go ahead and de facto concede that they're lying about that all along?
There was a little bit of trotting around that. Morrell in his section talks about it, and he makes the standard argument that yeah, it was this, that, and the other thing that led to this, that, and the other thing. And he, of course, is ignoring the collateral information or the information that was not produced as a result of torture that eventually actually led to the guy. So, it's a cherry-picked type argument that they're doing.
Yeah. Well, you know, that's one problem with even covering this story, even as closely as we're covering it here. You got to stop and back up and remember that tens and tens and tens of thousands of people were tortured by the military in Afghanistan and in Iraq, far more than the CIA program. And in fact, when we talked with Matthew Alexander, I forget his real name, but that's his pseudonym, the military interrogator who got the information that led to the killing of Zarqawi. He said on this show, direct quote, "I was authorized to use all these techniques. I just decided that I didn't think it would work, and so I did it my way instead," which was, you know, like you said, rapport building. But whether we're talking under Petraeus and McChrystal at Camp Nama, or as Fishback and Tony Lugaranis explained on the PBS torture documentary, The Torture Question. Tony Lugaranis said, man, we tortured these people in their living rooms. We tortured them in their backyards. We tortured them on the side of the road. We tortured them with green eggs and ham in a box with a fox and the rest by the tens and tens of thousands all day, every day for years. They tortured the people of Iraq because the word had gone down. Geneva Convention canceled. Gloves are off, do what you want, no rules. And that went from the highest CIA torturer down to the lowest specialist.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's no doubt about that. There was this argument does indeed keep surfacing in this book, that these were exceptional circumstances, and we were doing this because we had to do it to save the American people. Tenet says at one point the world was in danger. I mean, this is ridiculous hyperbole. And all these lines about, yeah, we're saving American lives and everything like that. We stopped terrorist acts and stuff. You know, this kind of stuff is a very selective way of looking at what is a very serious problem in terms of how the United States basically went off the rails. And has become the evil empire. But of course, that's not something they want to think about. And let me mention one other thing that's not in my article, which I think your listeners and you will find very interesting. The title of this book is Rebuttal, the CIA Response to the Senate Intelligence Committee Study of Its Detention and Interrogation Programs. And this is a book that would have been cleared by the censors at CIA. The CIA, by law, is not allowed to influence public opinion in the United States. So this book is illegal by its very nature. It says the title, The CIA Response. And since that book was vetted and cleared by the CIA, obviously they agree with the title. And so it raises a lot of interesting questions about the legality of these guys even writing this book.
Right.
And these guys, of course, also have second careers now. So there are other issues of conflict of interest and all kinds of things in terms of this.
And a huge question of just who the hell do they think they are, these guys, when they're spying on the Senate that's investigating their torture regime, for example, where, know that there's really the deep state, as you put it in your article, that controls America. But there are times where they reveal themselves as believing that they are far higher in rank than the chairman of the Senate Intelligence Committee, who created them and is charged with their oversight. I mean, these guys are way out of control here. They'll break any law. They'll directly trample right over the articles of the Constitution.
Yeah. Well, I say in my article, I said one might well ask whether publishing an ostensibly serious book justifying torture could even happen anywhere but in the United States.
Yep. Yeah, it's really something. And that's not a point about free speech. That's a point of America turning into some old world despotism is what that sounds like to me. Great work as always, Phil. Thank you so much.
Okay, Scott. Take care.
Appreciate it. That's the great Phil Giraldi, former CIA, former DIA. He's the executive director of the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org. He writes for UNS.com and the American Conservative Magazine, where this article is entitled The CIA's Torture Defenders. Hey, I'll check out the audiobook of Lou Rockwell's Fascism Versus Capitalism, narrated by me, Scott Horton, at audible.com. It's a great collection of his essays and speeches on the important tradition of liberty. From medieval history to the Ron Paul Revolution, Rockwell blasts our status enemies, profiles our greatest libertarian heroes, and prescribes the path forward in the battle against Leviathan. Fascism Versus Capitalism by Lou Rockwell for audiobook. Find it at Audible, Amazon, iTunes, or just click in the right margin of my website at scotthorton.org. Hey, y'all, Scott here for Samurai Tech Academy at MasterSamuraiTech.com. Modern appliance repair requires true technicians who can troubleshoot their high-tech electronics. If you're young and looking to make some real money, or you've been at it a while and just need to keep your skills up to date, Samurai Tech Academy teaches it all. And they'll also show you the business, how to own and run your own. Take a free sample course to see how easily you can learn appliance repair from MasterSamuraiTech.com. Use coupon code Scott Horton for 10% off any course or set of courses at MasterSamuraiTech.com.
All right, you guys. Welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, Scott Horton Show. Hey, all you people listening to just the interview archives later, you know that they come from this live show. Live noon to 2 on the Liberty Radio Network. That's Eastern Time. 11 to 1 Texas Time. LibertyRadioNetwork.com, LRN.FM.
All right. Next up is our friend Jason Ditz from antiwar.com. He is the news editor at antiwar.com, news.antiwar.com, covering all the bad news for you every single day. And I really don't know how you do it, man. You do it better than anybody does. Jason, welcome back to the show, dude. How are you? Oh, I can't hear you. Talk again. Nope, still can't hear you. Something wrong with your sound card, bud? Did I hit the wrong button? No. Uh-oh. Jason, I don't know if you can hear me, but I'm going to call you back on the phone, because this ain't working. Unless you can figure it out. It doesn't sound like it's figuring out there. All right, well, hang on just a sec, y'all.
The White House says it can prove that Saddam Hussein does have weapons of mass destruction, claiming it has solid evidence.
The White House insisted again today it does have solid evidence that Saddam Hussein is hiding an arsenal of prohibited weapons.
They might fight dirty, using weapons of mass destruction, chemical, biological, or radioactive.
There are ties between Saddam Hussein and Al-Qaeda.
Anthrax, smallpox.
Dirty bomb.
Dirty bomb.
Iraq Al-Qaeda connection.
Saddam Hussein and Al-Qaeda shared the same goal.
All right, all right. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to give you guys a headache, man. I'm just trying to fill a little bit of dead air here. All right, I'm blaming Skype. God dang Skype. I got Jason Ditz on the line. Hey, Jason, how are you, man?
I'm doing good, Scott. How are you?
I'm doing real good. Appreciate you joining us again on the show. Been too long since I had you on. Happy to have you back. There's so much going on. But let's start with Yemen, because that's the thing that no one else is talking about at all. Because, hey, we're leading from behind. And so all them Yemenis dying aren't quite newsworthy, at least in America. I guess there's some coverage in Europe. But anyway, tell us everything important that you think we need to know about the war going on in Yemen right now, please, sir, if that's not too broad of a question.
Wow, that's a broad question. It goes back quite a bit. So the Houthis are a largely political movement, but they're predominated by Shiite leadership. They're based around the northern part of the country along the Saudi border, and their longtime complaint was that governments have just kind of taxed them and that's it. I mean, they get even the limited services that most of Yemen gets, they really didn't get much at all. It's virtually the whole area is unpaved except for private roads. And I mean, it's really the poorest part of Yemen and also the one that got the least amount of attention. But when the original founder of the Houthis was a member of parliament who agreed to an alliance with the Saleh government on the idea that it would get some of this some of these political disputes resolved. Saleh needed an alliance to have a real majority government in a past election. And basically, he took the alliance and then didn't give anyone what they wanted. It started a protest movement. There were some violent crackdowns that turned into a outright rebellion in that region. And they've been fighting a war against them off and on for about a decade. And the war against the Houthis continued even after Saleh resigned in 2012. Now, when he resigned, President Hadi was quote-unquote elected to replace him. Basically, he was the U.S. choice for a new military dictator in Yemen, and the U.N. was on board with the idea. They elected him in a single-candidate election in which no one else was allowed to run and you weren't allowed to vote no. So he was elected to a two-year term, which was supposed to be up in early 2014. When early 2014 came around, he'd been fighting the Houthis all along. He said, no, because we're fighting the Houthis, we need to extend my term in office at least another year. So he extends his term, launches a bigger war against the Houthis, promptly loses that war, and the capital city falls in November of last year. So, interestingly, the Houthis don't really take over once they capture the capital city. They start saying, okay, we're going to have talks on a democratic transition and actual real elections this time. President Hadi wasn't keen on that idea, so he took off in January, resigned, moved to Aden, announced that he's going to have to take the country back militarily. In pretty short order, he lost to Aden, too, and fled to Saudi Arabia. So that brings us to March. In March, Saudi Arabia declares war, saying they have to reinstall the rightful president of Yemen, and they've killed thousands of people. They retook Aden, which has been, from the Hadi government's perspective, redefined as the new capital city, and they've been fighting a war there ever since. It's been a really bloody war. There are now thousands of Saudi and Emirati and Bahraini troops on the ground. And to make matters worse, there's this naval blockade, which Yemen's a mostly desert country. It doesn't have much agriculture. Also not a great place to fish, even though it's a coastal area. So about 90% of their food is imported on a yearly basis. But this blockade's made it almost impossible to import food. So you've got kind of a looming famine, particularly in the parts of the country still held by the Houthis, because every time someone tries to deliver food to those parts of the country, Saudi Arabia destroys airports, they destroy naval ports. They just want to make sure that the food doesn't arrive, which they say is because they think weapons are being smuggled in. And they're really setting the stage for what, I mean, of the 4,500 people or so killed already, a lot of them are civilians, but they're really setting the stage for what could be a huge civilian death toll from just the famine alone.
Yeah, and now, so let's really examine that part of it. This number 90%, 80%, 90%, that's what I've heard too, this whole 9 months long. That's what Patrick Coburn says and the UN says, and I know that you're getting that from real and credible and multiple sources. But they've been saying that for so long, and the blockade has been going on for so long, I gotta wonder whether we're talking about an impending famine or an actual famine. People can't go very long without food. So if they're not importing their food and they really are that dependent on it, obviously the war has, made the price of gasoline prohibitively expensive. So all the distribution channels are shut down and everything. I guess, not like I'm begging for it or something, but it just seems like we must be missing the part where the numbers must already be coming in of people laying down and dying for lack of something to eat there, or else what are we missing? Somebody smuggling stuff in from Oman somehow, or what?
Whoa, I'm sorry. I don't know what that is.
Nope, gone now. Go ahead.
Okay. There's definitely been some smuggling.
I'm not really sure where it's all coming from. Music's playing there, Jason, so let's go ahead and stop here. I'm sorry, I never look at the clock when I'm doing this show. I should, though. I'm going to let you answer that on the other side of this break, just how desperate is the humanitarian situation there, and then we're going to get back to the actual war, the goals and the means and the ends, and what the hell's going on, America's role, of course. It's the great Jason Ditz, news.antiwar.com. You hate government? One of them libertarian types? Or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers. Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still, if you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. Hey y'all, guess what? You can now order transcripts of any interview I've done for the incredibly reasonable price of $2.50 each. Listen, finding a good transcriptionist is near impossible, but I've got one now. Just go to scotthorton.org/transcripts, enter the name and date of the interview you want written up, click the PayPal button, and I'll have it in your email in 72 hours, max. You don't need a PayPal account to do this. Man, I'm really going to have to learn how to talk more good. That's scotthorton.org/transcripts. All right, you guys, welcome back. Wrapping up the show already for today, man. Got Jason Ditz on the line. He's the news editor at antiwar.com, news.antiwar.com. We're talking about the war in Yemen. And sorry, I know it's a big complicated question, and I know that you're in Michigan, not reporting out of Yemen and stuff like this, so it's okay if you don't know, but I just wonder, maybe it has been reported and I just really have not been paying close enough attention. Of just how bad the famine is already hitting the people of Yemen. This famine that was announced beforehand to be the inevitable, predictable result of this war, as warned by so many back months ago, Jason.
Yeah, it's really odd that we have predictions of the famine that are roughly the same as the predictions of the famine that we saw 5 months ago when the war began. But we really don't get a lot of detail about just how bad it is, especially in the Houthi territory, because most of the reporting is coming out of Aden, which the pro-Saudi forces control, and they're allowing food into the territory they control, of course. But that's a pretty small portion of the country. I mean, Aden's a pretty heavily populated city, but other than that, there's not a lot that is controlled by the pro-Saudi forces. So we really don't know how bad it's gotten. A few months ago, the reporting on the ground was you would see the price of staple foods like flour double and then double again and then double again. And then finally, they were getting to the point where in a lot of neighborhoods, you couldn't get flour at any price. I'm sure there's hoarding going on. That too hasn't been as widely reported as you would think. But I think a lot of it is we really don't know what's going on in those parts of Yemen.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the other thing. I mean, when we talked with Matthew Akins on the show, the only reason he had something to say was because he and a colleague had snuck across from Djibouti and snuck into the country across, you know, past the blockade. There's no way for, you know, a New York Times reporter to even get there. I mean, not that we really want to hear their version anyway, but yeah, so a real lack of information coming out of Yemen. And also, like I was implying there in the introduction, because America's leading from behind, as they call it, there just seems to be total ignorance on this topic, or it just ranks so low in importance in terms of national media, national newspapers, and TV. They just don't cover it at all. There's a great article in Counterpunch where she has to insist that, hey, this is America's war, guys. The Saudis can't do any of this without us. And, you know, I wonder what all you know about that. Obviously, the Wall Street Journal has covered this a little bit, and there have been some other reports, but it mostly seems to just go without saying that America's running this war for the Saudis, Jason. But what do we really know about it?
Well, it's really incredible. It gets such limited coverage, America's involvement, but whenever we get information, it's exactly as you say, it really is, in a lot of ways, America's war. U.S. Air Force planes are doing most of the in-air refueling for Saudi bombers. U.S. surveillance planes are helping them pick targets. U.S. military advisors are basically consulting with the Saudis on everything. And U.S. warships have, on occasion, even participated in the naval blockade. So the U.S. has done everything except literally drop the bombs. And even in that, they're picking where the bombs are being dropped and just letting the Saudis do it with planes that we've been giving them over the course of the last couple of decades. So the idea that this isn't an American fight at all is just ridiculous. But for some reason, there's just really not much interest in it.
All right. So now when it started, the question was, I'm sure I asked you in this very same way, how the hell are they supposed to reinstall Hadi with air power? I mean, that's stupid, but now they've invaded. But who's invaded and how much? And do they have a real force? You said that they're declaring aid in the new capital now, which kind of sounds like a funny sore loser kind of thing. But on the other hand, it means that, hey, he's not in exile in Saudi anymore. And they are, again, backed by the American imperial superpower. So is it just a matter of time before this ground force, how big is the ground force? And you think they will be capable of reinstalling Hadi in power in Sana'a, because after all, like you said, the Houthis, they're from the north. They're not the you know, natural power regime to reside in Sana'a. If anybody is, it's not them.
Well, I mean, it's difficult to say. I think we're heading towards just a split of Yemen in the long run. We have there are thousands, but it's single digit thousands of foreign troops involved, mostly Saudi and UAE troops. We don't really know the size of the pro-Hadi Yemeni force, but it's mostly just auxiliaries. It's not the real Yemeni military. It's mostly people that were, tribal allies and people who went to Saudi Arabia to get a couple of weeks of training and a weapon.
Mm-hmm.
So they don't really have a proper military. And the thing I think is most interesting and has only been covered on very rare occasion is there's been a huge active separatist movement running out of Aden for years. And ever since the pro-Saudi forces, the Hadi government, took over Aden and declared it their new capital, they're not flying the flag of Yemen. They're flying the flag of old South Yemen in Aden.
Mm-hmm. These are the socialists that we talked about, right? Where that one guy's in the documentary saying, don't call me Al-Qaeda. I say, Viva Hugo Chavez, Revolution!
Right.
Which is just hilarious to see Yemenis talking like that to me. But anyway, legacy of the Cold War days.
It seems like that's probably the most likely outcome of this, is that, you know, Hadi himself is from the South. A lot of his allies are from the South. I think the creation of a new South Yemen that is a Saudi ally and sort of a transition to a Houthi-dominated democracy in the North that isn't necessarily very friendly with either Saudi Arabia or the United States, probably what's going to end up happening here. I mean, of course, the Saudis are still insisting that they're a matter of days or a few weeks from liberating the entire country, but they've been saying that for months now, and they really don't seem to be gaining much ground.
Yeah. Well, now, so what about Saleh? Because the last I heard, he was back and had allied himself with his old enemies in the Houthis, because he, in fact, is a Zaydi, right? He wasn't part of the Houthi movement, but he's part of that same Shia sect that the Houthi movement is from. And so now he's allied with them and I guess was working on getting his old throne back. But what's the latest about his role in this?
Well, it's not clear. As you say, he is a Zaydi. The Houthi movement was never really a religious movement, so much as that the political leadership of it, the Houthi family, were also Zaydis, and their district, when they had a parliamentary seat, was in the Zaydi North. They really are kind of natural allies in that regard, but Saleh has claimed that early in the war, the Saudis were offering him money to support the war and offering him whatever. He kind of said he wanted to stay out of it, so they blew up his house with one of their airstrikes. And ever since his house got destroyed, he's insisted, he's called on the military to back the Houthis in resisting the Saudi invasion.
And how's that going?
He was dictator for so long, and despite Hadi being a military man himself, and despite Hadi trying to purge the leadership of Saleh supporters, a huge amount of the military is still pro Saleh. So basically, the Houthis have the bulk of the Yemeni military on their side.
Man, this is just going to keep going. There's no end in sight. Wait, that was the last question. Real quickly, any positive sign of talks here?
Well, the Houthis are in favor of talks, and they've said that they would support talks, and they've gone to a couple of planned negotiations that the UN set up, but the Hadi forces keep rejecting these talks and saying that the U.S. pushed a resolution through the U.N. Security Council saying Hadi's the rightful ruler, and the Security Council demands they could get all the cities. So they keep insisting, well, if the Houthis want to talk, they need to unilaterally disarm and surrender the entire country first. But that's obviously not going to happen. So for talks, I think it's probably going to be quite a while before the Hadi government is resigned to having to negotiate.
Yep. All right. Well, thanks as always for the bad news, Jason. You do a real great job, man. I appreciate it.
Thank you, and sorry about the microphone on my side. I think I have it sorted out for future Skype calls.
Oh, yeah. Nah, no problem. The phone worked great, so no big deal at all. All right, talk to you soon, dude. Appreciate it. All right, y'all, that is the great Jason Ditz, news.antiwar.com. I'm seriously, man. I'm serious. There is no better source of information, no better single source of information about American foreign policy on this planet than, well, antiwar.com in general, but especially Jason's work at news.antiwar.com. Thanks for listening. See y'all next week.